Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
But what COVID is perhaps changing the goalposts here is if you say to someone who's overweight, has a poor diet, you say, come on, you need to try to change because you will avoid the risk of chronic disease in 20 years' time, they may not be so interested. But actually with COVID, what it's showing is people who have these comorbidities are more likely to get a fatal illness now. So actually, COVID, the horrible, terrible catastrophe that might actually be getting people thinking, well, actually, maybe I need to be changing now, not to prevent a disease in 20 years' time, to prevent a disease which could happen next week.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. I'm delighted to welcome back Professor Robert Thomas to the show. You may remember that we spoke with Professor earlier this year about oncology and how he encourages diet and lifestyle during treatment of cancer as well as after treatment and the evidence base behind that. His brilliant book, Keep Healthy After Cancer, which is something I linked to in the show notes. But today we're going to be talking about something that may be perceived as quite controversial. Can you eat for COVID? Now, I want to make it clear at the start that we're not talking about replacing treatments that we have for COVID-19 in the hospitals with food or singular supplements or singular foods in their entirety. What we're talking about is the foundation behind why certain people might have a worse outcome of COVID-19 when they come into contact with it. But also, we're going to be talking about his current trial using food supplements and probiotics as an addition to conventional treatment and exploring whether that has any elements or any evidence of improvement in severity or reduction in the complications associated with this disease. It's something that sounds very controversial on the outset, but I think that's because as allopathic doctors, we are used to using drugs and pharmaceuticals alone rather than exploring other things that we should really be paying a lot more attention to, particularly as more and more people are becoming used to the idea that a healthy lifestyle and a foundation which lessens the likelihood of comorbidities can improve outcomes with this particular virus, but also other conditions as well. On the show, we talk about his current experience of COVID on the ward and how that compares to earlier in the year, his latest trial using food supplements, as well as how they went about choosing what types of foods to put in a pill form, the formulation of the product with industry, the confounding that is likely to be picked up, but what the potential results could mean for medicine going forward, his experience of conducting the research and just how long it took to get ethical approval, as well as why lifestyle modification and the prevention of comorbidities has to be the foundation before we start adding supplements to the list of interventions as well. I think you're going to find this a really useful podcast. Professor is a pleasure to speak to, and I also cook him a very easy recipe that is full of prebiotics and polyphenols, things that he talks about. And as someone who is a self-confessed can't cook, won't cook, I think I converted him with this recipe. You can check it out on YouTube. But for now, onto the podcast. All right. Thanks so much for coming into the studio.
You're very welcome. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. The reason why we're doing the second podcast is because I really wanted to teach you how to cook. After the last time we chatted, I remember you saying you're not much of a cook. You can't cook the same kind of meals that I can cook. So this is really a challenge for me to try and teach you something that you can you know, cook for your family afterwards.
I think it's a bigger challenge than you think, actually. First of all, I'll never be able to cook like you can cook.
Okay.
But I can't even cook at all, is the important point. I know a lot about food, I have to say, and about nutrition and what's in it, but I just don't have your knack, I'm afraid.
Okay,
but,
cool.
I'll be proved wrong at the end of the show.
Okay, brilliant. I'm glad. All right, so the first things first, we're going to be cooking a Greek style bean stew. It's got cinnamon, honey, oregano. We're going to finish it off with feta. And it's you can also make it with orzo if you want to make it a little bit more heavy. I'm going to keep it quite light with just some chopped tomatoes and some really good prebiotic vegetables as well.
Excellent.
First things first, turn on the oven, 200 degrees centigrade, and make sure you've got enough space for it, and that's it.
Okay. And then we're going to do some first chicken. Thing is to buy an oven.
You don't have an oven?
Not yet. We're waiting for one. So,
really?
So there will be one shortly.
Well, this is quite versatile because you can put it on a hob.
Okay, good.
You do have a hob?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So the first time we talked about healthy living, a lot of the stuff that you've talked about in your book, Keeping Healthy After Cancer, Keep Healthy After Cancer. Today, I think I want to talk a bit more about gut health in particular. This is something you have a strong interest in, as well as some of the studies that you're doing with regard to COVID, and also about sports performance, nutrition, and some other things that you've clearly done a lot of reading around. So, but how are you doing, first of all, with the whole COVID situation and still being a consultant on the medical wards?
Yeah, well, as you know, I'm a consultant oncologist, so that's affected oncology quite a bit. We've had to shorten radiotherapy regimes. We've had to think twice about starting people on chemotherapy. And, you know, it's the saddest thing is that some people have delayed presenting. So in the last few weeks, I've seen quite a few young people actually with tumours without COVID would have presented probably 2 or 3 months earlier. And that's going to affect their prognosis. It means they're more likely to need chemotherapy and have all the effects of that. And of course, the hospital's been super busy.
Yeah.
So we've all been dragged, like yourself, been dragged up to the medical wards and covering A&E and things. So, but fortunately, unless we get a second peak, the peak seems to have gone. We've only got 4 patients at the moment in Bedford, one of the hospitals I work in.
Yeah.
And I do, as you know, I do a ward round most mornings to try and pick up patients who want to go into our study.
Yeah.
Which we can talk about more later if you want.
Well, let's talk about that actually, because I'm fascinated by the study that you're doing, and also taking the opportunity to promote it as well. I think that'd be brilliant.
Yeah. Well, it's quite clear from the data so far, without sort of blaming people for catching COVID, which is the last thing we want to do. Yeah. But if you look at something like the New York data, where 15,200 people died, very tragic. Of those, only 99 didn't have something else wrong with them. So obesity, heart problems, diabetes. And of course, you don't want to blame people for having those illnesses, but we know over a long period of time what you eat and how much exercise you do, et cetera, and your lifestyle choices do strongly determine whether you're going to get those lifestyle-related disease. So taking that as a sort of basic hypothesis, we're thinking, well, if someone gets COVID, although, we can't reverse time and sort of, once the diabetes is set in, but could we do something with nutrition to improve their immunity, inflammatory status within the time frame where it would affect the natural course of the disease? Of course, we don't know that, and that's why we need to do a study. So the hypothesis is if you get people and give them phytochemical-rich foods, foods with lots of aroma, color and taste, all the things you cook with, we can change their gut health with targeted probiotics. Mm-hmm. We could reduce the dysfunction in inflammation and reduce the course of the illness and hopefully improve outcomes. So that's what we're currently doing, randomizing people to a placebo or that intervention.
And just taking a step back with regard to the likelihood of adverse outcomes with COVID if you do have comorbidities, what are the different mechanisms of action as to why you're more at risk if you do have comorbidities like high blood pressure, obesity, etc.?
Well, there's twofold. One is if you have problems with your heart and lungs. When you have a terrible virus like COVID, it puts enormous strain on those. So if you're weak to start with, you're more likely to get fatal consequences. But I'm more interested in the chance of actually getting a severe form of COVID, because we know many people get COVID and just have a temperature for a few days or a bit of a headache. And that's what I'm trying to look at. Why are those people less affected? And I think gut health, my opinion is gut health has a lot to do with that. As we'll talk about in this program, there's lots of issues which adversely affect gut health. And we have, you know, millions, trillions of bacteria in our gut, part of the microbiome. Those form or stimulate the immunity. So if we have a bad gut, you have a dysfunctional immunity, which means you have lower immune surveillance, so you're more likely to catch an infection, and you have higher chronic inflammation, which means your reaction to that infection is dysfunctional. So, for example, you could overreact to the virus and cause the cytokine storm, which is the thing which really affects the lungs, and that's actually ultimately fatal. You can get really bad diarrhea, which many people are getting, which you can lose electrolytes, etc., can also be fatal. So if you start off with a poor gut health, you're more likely to catch COVID and get a severe form of it. And when you've got it, you're more likely then to overreact to the virus and create this excess inflammation, and you get these exudates in the lung, which are the fatal form.
Yeah.
And that's the main study is the hydroxychloroquine, and that's an out of date malaria tablet, and that's looking at ways to dampen down excess inflammation. It's the same sort of pathway, but I strongly believe food would be even more powerful, but harder to prove.
Yes,
harder to control in a study, to be honest.
Absolutely. Well, that's why it's great that you're doing this in a way that meets the scientific rigor with the randomization. And what exactly are you putting in the intervention arm?
Right. So there's two interventions. One is a mixture of lactobacillus probiotics, which has been specifically made for the trial, called your Gut Plus, and we're not trying to emulate the whole gut microbiome. I mean,
that'd be pretty hard.
Trillions, yeah. You need a tablet the size of this room, and there's trillions of different bacteria, as you know, and there's new strains being discovered every week. So it's an uncharted passage. Excuse the metaphor. What we're trying to do is just support the gut with butyrate forming bacteria. So these are the healthy bacteria, or the bacteroidetes type bacteria, which they're anti-inflammatory. They metabolize polyphenols into butyrate. Butyrate feeds the gut health. They are an antidote to carcinogens. They restore gut integrity, so they make the gut healthy. And if the gut's healthy, you have a healthier immunity. So the first part is just to top up your probiotic intake. The second intervention is a polyphenol-rich food, whole food supplement. Okay. So these aren't chemicals removed from foods. They're just foods which have been concentrated and put into a pill. So it just boosts your intake.
Okay.
And
freeze-dried or something?
Yeah, they can be freeze-dried. They can just be ground, in the case of turmeric, for example, which is one of the ingredients. Within that, we have also done some extracts from that food, but it's only the whole oil extracts. It's not actually like removing a chemical like vitamin A or vitamin E or lycopene or something like that, which is a much more in-depth process. So essentially, it's a food in a pill.
Okay.
And we looked actually at the SARS the last SARS outbreak. There's a lot of data from China and the Far East and India where they've looked at which foods have direct antiviral properties.
Oh, really?
And there's surprisingly quite a few, and not just for SARS, it was looking at herpes and HPV. So one of the ways these foods work is they can have direct antiviral properties. The other way they work is they can regulate an appropriate inflammatory response. Okay. So they improve the immunity, and then they avoid this excess inflammation, which is also important. Mm-hmm. But they have lots of other benefits, which we can talk about for hours. Yeah. So the intervention is a series of polyphenol-rich. And we just looked at the trials which were published over the last 5 years, and we sort of picked the best bet, basically. Yeah. And we looked at foods in different categories. So there's no point having ginger and turmeric, and you know, it's really the same polyphenols. Same polyphenol, right. So we've got things like chamomile tea, aloe vera, turmeric, pomegranate, green tea, which are packed full of these really healthy polyphenols. And we're combining that with a probiotic and comparing that against placebo. So half the people in the trial, I'm afraid, are on placebo, which we don't know who. Yeah. And the other half is in that intervention.
I want to talk a bit more about those polyphenols, particularly from the different types of foods that you just suggested. But let me introduce you to my set of polyphenols for
this recipe.
Exactly, yeah. So we've got, just to keep you up to speed, as you've seen, I've done it exactly the same time as we've been chatting here. There's chopped leeks and chopped celery. You can chop.
Yep.
Good.
I can do that.
Good, right answer. I've also put the stalks of the parsley in here as well, because it's got fiber, it's got those polyphenols as well. You want to put those in. Two, because we're cooking for about six people here, your kids here as well. We've got some white beans, two cans of white beans, and then two cans of chopped tomatoes that I've just put in here. I've added some seasoning and a little bit of chili flakes with some black pepper. And now we're going to go in with the spices. So I'm hitting it pretty hard with about a tablespoon of oregano. Mm-hmm. Cumin. You don't have any pet hates or anything like that, no? So we've got about a teaspoon or so of cumin. I usually do it by eye, but I'm doing it like this just to show you how easy it is.
Yeah.
I hope you're taking notes. I'll send you the recipe afterwards. A stick of cinnamon.
Okay.
So cinnamon goes in. Three sprigs of rosemary. Again, pick it up from any supermarket. A couple of bay leaves. I keep these in the freezer, so you know you can use them whenever. So those have just been taken out for a little while. I'm going to add about 2 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar just to add some acidity, because you want to kind of balance the flavors. Got loads of sweet flavors coming from the tomatoes and the honey that I'm about to put in. So you always want to balance sweet and acidity. And just about a tablespoon or so of honey. You don't need to add the honey, but I find that it does really balance the meal. And I think, you know, part of the flavor, part of the enjoyment of food is making sure you've got plenty of flavor in there as well. I'm going to add a tiny bit of the hot water just to help everything come together. Just give a little bit of liquid. The other thing that you can add to this meal is orzo. So that's like a dried pasta, which kind of resembles kind of like rice.
Yeah.
If you didn't want to add orzo, you want to add something a little bit more high fiber, you could add something like a rice pea pasta or, you know, other sort of whole wheat pastas. Those are absolutely fine. It's going to add a little bit more hot water, and then this goes in the oven, and we're going to continue our podcast whilst I'm quote unquote cooking.
And you'd add it at this stage, the pasta or rice?
Okay. I would add it at this stage. Everything goes into one pan. This is sort of, this is a 3-2-1 meal. So it's an adapted recipe from one of my 3-2-1 recipes from the new book that's coming out in January 2021. And it's literally this simple.
Yeah.
Because most people suffer. I mean, you work on the wards at the moment. You know, the last thing you want to do when you come back home is cook like a massive meal that's complicated. It's got like 2 or 3 pounds on the go, whatever. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of meal you want to be able to cook.
Absolutely. Something that you make it look very simple.
Yeah, and it is simple. Okay. It is simple. Right. Trust me. Pop this into your oven at 200 degrees centigrade that already pre-warms, and this goes in for about 20 to 25 minutes. And that's it. And then I'm just going to put a timer. So that's 20, 25 minutes. We'll check it out. Let's say about let's say 35 minutes past the hour. Okay. I'll take it out and let it stand for about 5 minutes, and then we're just going to garnish with the rest of the parsley leaves and a bit of feta, some aged cheese, some probiotics, yeah. And that's it.
Brilliant. Looking forward to it.
Good. We're going to stop for a second whilst I clear this down, and then we can get on with the rest of the podcast.
Okay.
Great. Well, we're going to talk a bit more about the research that went into as to why you put those particular products into the intervention. Mm. But also you wanted to mention the ingredients that I just put in there.
Talk about both of those.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, the theme of today is gut health as well as other things. And there's various ways you can promote gut health. So I would like to split it up into... it's not as simple as this. So there's two types of bacteria. There's the good bacteria and the bad bacteria, or friendly and unfriendly. Other people call it pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. The official name, if I can get it right, is Bacteroidetes are the good ones, and Firmicutes are the bad ones. But anyway, so if you have foods with bacteria in, so you mentioned the feta cheese, that's fermented, so that will have a lactobacillus type friendly bacteria. We're going to put that in afterwards. But actually, it's the prebiotics, as you know, which determine a lot of the of which bacteria are going to grow and which aren't going to grow into your gut. So you put leeks in, an albumin vegetable, and they're full of prebiotic soluble fibers, or fermentable soluble fibers. And what they do is there's a number of things. First of all, they are metabolized into butyrate. So they get polyphenols, which we'll mention in a minute, and they metabolize polyphenols into butyrate. Now, butyrate feeds the healthy gut, so it feeds the gut, and in return, other healthy bacteria feed off butyrate as well. So if you have more healthy gut growing, healthy bacteria growing, there's not enough room for the unhealthy bacteria or the pathogenic bacteria to grow. Are you putting mushrooms in there? You're not putting mushrooms in
there? I could put mushrooms in there. A really good way of adding mushrooms to it would be if you use the dehydrated mushrooms, because they have a lot more flavor and it preserves a lot of the polyphenols and I forget the name of them, the ergogenic acids, I think they are. They're a novel antioxidant that you find in different types of mushrooms. Mm. And you get loads of different types as well in a pack. So trompette, girole, chanterelle, all those different ones.
Yeah, lots of those foods you've got contain natural antibiotics, particularly the mushrooms. Mm. And it's a strange quirk of nature that those antibiotics, not like the ones we're taking, they actually tend to kill the Firmicutes bacteria, the bad bacteria, but they don't kill the good bacteria. Ah. So they preferentially encourage the good bacteria to grow. And when you've got a good ratio of good to bad bacteria, that improves gut integrity, and there's all sorts of things which you get from that.
Yeah. But there you go. So, I mean, the prebiotics that we add to our food, I think a lot of people would prefer to use a supplement because it has sort of a medicinal feel, you know, the fact that you're purchasing something that is usually quite expensive without really laying the foundations for something like that to work. And I think, you know, making sure that people are aware of the importance of the aluminum, the umbilifers, vegetables, all the different types of high fiber items as well, to ensure the probiotics that we have naturally in our food, as well as the ones that we might take in supplemental form, are going to be doing the job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I actually think that the prebiotics are probably more important than the probiotics, although in a British society, we don't tend to eat much bacteria. I mean, if I was in Japan last year, and there's loads of fermented foods. Mm. And Korea, there's kimchi. Mm. Even in Eastern Europe, there's lots of fermented foods, pickles, sauerkraut and things. Mm. We do have yogurt, but a lot of the yogurts we see in the supermarket aren't actually live yogurts.
Yeah.
So if you want to boost your bacterial intake, you know, look for the live variety or mature cheeses. Mm. Kefir, you're seeing more and more now. But it's also the prebiotics, the beans, the legumes, which are beans and seeds, onions, artichokes, chickpeas, those sort of things. They are packed full of prebiotics, but also packed full of phytosterols, which reduce cholesterol, phytoestrogens, which have anti-cancer properties, particularly the hormone-related cancers. But many people avoid those foods because, you know, you take you've got white beans, which is a great prebiotic. If you haven't eaten beans for a while and you eat beans, you know, you get a bit bloated, and you have gas. But it's very obvious from the data that if you have beans, it's about a quarter of a cup of those sort of foods a day, which seems quite a lot. You don't get that bloating and gas. You only get it at the beginning when you're not used to their intake.
Yeah.
So you have to get past that barrier and start eating them regularly, and then you really reap the benefits.
Yeah. And going back to the list of foods that you added to your intervention, you mentioned green tea, chamomile. What was the do you know what the full list is, or are you allowed to, or is that proprietary information?
It's quite an extensive list, so I can't often remember. So what we did, as I said, we used the probiotics, which I've just mentioned, mainly the lactobacillus, because they're the sort of safest ones. They are metabolized. They metabolize polyphenols into butyrate, which feeds the healthy gut. So that was the choice of that. We didn't want a probiotic supplement which had hundreds of different bacteria, which we're not really sure about.
Yeah.
Certainly didn't want to put anyone at risk.
Yes.
So we went for a safer option. And we made sure it's strong enough. It had 10 billion colony forming units.
Gotcha.
So it's quite a strong one, but a safe variety.
Okay.
So on the food capsule, which as I said, is just simply whole foods, and it's a convenient way to boost your intake. We'd never say it's instead of eating food like yours, but it would boost your intake, particularly if you take it, say, with your breakfast, a time when a lot of British people don't have a lot of polyphenols. You know, they tend to go for white toast, sugary jam. And we looked at the ones which had prebiotic properties, so they're going to promote the growth of the bacteria, but also full of polyphenols, which are which have enormous health benefits. So just to run through those quickly, we've got they restore inflammation, so they reduce excess inflammation, and they improve immune surveillance. So they just make your immune system to run more efficiently. They affect the oxidative enzymes, so they encourage the formation of oxidative enzymes when we're under attack.
Okay.
So unlike vitamin A and vitamin E, which are direct antioxidants, and you can actually overdo it with those. You can have too much oxidative capacity. These just encourage the appropriate oxidative response, so it avoids oxidative stress, which is carcinogenic and damaging for all sorts of systems in your body. So we chose the foods which had most of those, and as I said, it was green tea and turmeric are always up high on the list. We had some pomegranate, and actually chamomile seems to be high in a type of polyphenol which has direct antiviral properties.
Okay.
And same as pomegranate.
All right.
And those polyphenols have been shown to reduce viral replication and reduce the ability of the virus to penetrate into a normal cell and shred. So when viruses go into a normal cell, they sort of attack it, they replicate, and they shred viruses back into the bloodstream. Wow. So the hypothesis is it could stop the infection of a cell, stop the damage to the cell, and stop it spreading.
Wow. And looking at the list of foods that you put into this supplement, was that on the basis of observational studies for people consuming those foods and having less likelihood of worse outcomes with the initial SARS outbreak, or were there a collection of both observational and some intervention studies perhaps done in India and China?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot we don't know about these foods, and most of the data from what I've just talked about come from animal and cell line studies. And then on the other side of the coin are observational studies. So if you look at a population which eat more of these foods, they tend to have a lower effect from viruses and other chronic conditions. Mm. But the amount of evidence from, you know, class A studies, double blind randomized trials, is lacking.
Yeah.
And that's why we wanted to do this trial. You know, why are there so few double-blind randomized studies? Yeah. Is difficult to explain. The conspiracy theorists say that because these are not there's no intellectual property around them. You can't sort of trademark turmeric, etc. Yeah. So even though it's in a capsule, at the end of the day, these things can be easily be bought over the counter and be made by multiple different people.
Yeah.
So there's no sort of protection from a drug company to, or no incentive for a drug company to do them.
Mm.
But in our trials unit, we just want to get the information out there, and then people can make their own choices.
And choices, yeah. And is the aim to have a commercial spin-off from this collection of different ingredients, or is it just for public information about the impact of perhaps having these in your normal diet?
Well, I mean, research is expensive.
Yeah.
We got donated the probiotic from Your Gut Plus, and so that was probably about £20,000 worth of probiotic we got free for the study, and no doubt the company who's making it will want to sell it. But you know, they're not particularly unique. There's a lot of different companies could make the same sort of thing. Of the food capsule, again, they're not there's no intellectual property around them. I suppose for the company who supplied it to us, if the trial does turn out to be significant, they would get a bit of a head start, and no doubt they would be selling it.
Yeah.
But we get the products for free, and you know, so it's a two-way situation. It's another sort of way of funding studies, because we're not going to get grants from drug companies.
Absolutely,
we're
not going.
And we could try to go through these sort of 150-page application forms for money, and you know, that's going to take a year.
Yeah.
And for this study, we didn't have a year. It already took 4 months to get through the ethics committees the MHRA.
Even now?
Yeah, I mean, that was fast track.
Wow.
Normally, it takes well over 18 months to get a trial through. So the fast track is even a little bit slow for us.
Yeah, especially when you're struggling to recruit patients for the trial as well, particularly right now.
Well, it's a bit of a shame, because we started the process in February when we were getting 100 patients a day through casualty. And we sort of anticipated we'd get it finished by about July. And, you know, but we had to go to the MHRA, which is the Drug Regulatory Authority, because they get very confused with food in trials. Because they in their mindset is just drugs.
Yeah.
So when you say it's a food, and they say, well, it's a randomized trial. I said, yes, but you can investigate foods. It's not against the law. There's a loop you have to go through, which takes several months before they actually understand that foods could be beneficial to health.
Right. Yeah.
Which seems to be quite alien to many people. So once we got past that, we were allowed. They gave us all we wanted for them is permission to proceed.
Yeah.
And that took 4 months.
Wow.
And of course, the number of patients coming through is less and less, which is good, of course, but it means we're going to be much slower getting the answer for this study.
Do you think there's scope for people becoming sort of social scientists in this era, where, you know, people could, like you said, purchase these food supplements themselves, enroll themselves in the study, have a positive test for COVID, and actually document their symptoms, if there's a recurrence, the severity of the symptoms, etc., over a period of time, and you can actually map out whether people who took the intervention had positive benefits or not?
With a clinical trial, you have to really control everything, because what you don't want is you want objective data. So, and you need independent statisticians to come in and analyze your data for you. And even then, with COVID, we started off thinking, oh, it's going to be a temperature and a cough. But actually, it's not. It's, as you know, it's diarrhea, it's extreme fatigue. And we have to use validated questionnaires. So we've had to go back a few times and do trial amendments to, like, we've got fatigue now as the main endpoint. because that seems to be the most common symptom.
Wow.
Especially as people who've had, say, the disease, the peak of the disease, say, a month ago. But if you start, you know, that is a problem. If people hear what I've said about the ingredients, they go out and buy them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're healthy things. They're not going to do any harm. Mm. But we don't know they work, and we really need to know the answer. Mm. Because if they do work, we could expand that information across the world. We could then do further studies, sort of homing into which of those ingredients has the best benefit. Mm. I think with food, to have a mixture of a lot of things is always better.
Yeah.
And otherwise you go down the drug route, don't you? Taking out one chemical. Mm. So it's an issue. And one thing we've noticed with recruitment is when we start mentioning the word probiotic, people are very unhappy to be randomized.
Right.
Because they've heard the benefits of probiotics. Yeah. They've taken antibiotics when they've had their COVID. Mm. Their gut health is probably all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're thinking, well, actually, I want the probiotic.
Yeah.
So actually, we're doing another trial amendment. So both groups will actually get the probiotic.
Oh, really?
And we're randomizing the other food.
Gotcha.
Scientifically, that's less robust.
Uh-huh.
Because you've given both interventions, but it means that we can give something positive to the patients in the trial, and they can start seeing a benefit because people are reporting benefits post-COVID to probiotics, actually. So that's going to be, I think, from next week, which is, second meeting in August, they'll be all having the Yogurt Plus, and they'll be randomized to the
food supplement. Wow, that's super interesting. I mean, already you're going to have to gear yourself up for being not attacked, but there's a softer word for that when, you know, your food supplement contains a list of so many different ingredients. Like, well, the scientist will say, well, how do you know it was the chamomile instead of the green tea or whatever, and how do you know it's a combination rather than just the mushrooms doing all the work, sort of thing. Yeah. And I think we're always going to have to deal with that when it comes to nutritional science. But I think the more money we invest in preventative measures and management measures using simple lifestyle and dietary means, the better the outcomes for most people. And I think this extends, as you've been talking about for a number of years now, into oncology as well.
Well, as you may know, we about 5-6 years ago, we did another similar study using a supplement which had broccoli, green tea, turmeric, and pomegranate. Mm. And we looked at men on active surveillance for early prostate cancer. Mm. And we had exactly the same questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we didn't...
Carry on talking. I'm just going to pull this out of the oven.
Okay, good. Yeah. So... We didn't want to extract one chemical. We wanted the opposite of a drug trial. And that study was highly significant. In fact, it showed a 64% reduction in the rate of PSA progression in men with early disease. And that resulted in a very significant difference in outcome. It stopped people going on to radical interventions and kept many people on active surveillance. And then when we presented that to ASCO, the world's biggest cancer conference, all these questions came. But we were actually very pleasantly surprised, because every year they get 10 papers to be the most important papers for that disease, for prostate cancers, in the plenary sessions. And we were invited to be one of those.
Yeah.
Of course, that upset quite a lot of people. You know, there's 44,000 oncologists around the world, and obviously a lot of them are sort of... paid, you know, supported by drug companies, etc. I don't want to say there's a big conspiracy I had to sort of fly economy and stay in a B&B down the road while they were in the 5-star hotels. Anyway, no bitterness there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of people say, how do you know which one works? I said, well, look, it's probably the combination of it all, the same way in diet. You know, you have to... and each of those, they said, well, which polyphenol? I said, well, in turmeric alone, there are 120 different phytochemicals. Mm. In green tea, there are hundreds of different phytochemicals. Mm. All we know is from the cohort data, the laboratory data, we know that these foods have definite medicinal properties. Mm. And we now know from that trial, if you boost them, particularly, as I say, taking them in the morning and lunchtime in times of the day you wouldn't have them normally, we know they have beneficial properties. And I think there's loads more trials waiting to be done on that sort of thing, which will show a benefit.
Do you think there's scope, and this is really high level thinking here, and I'm thinking with my sort of like public health obesity strategy hat on, where if there is a clear benefit to be determined by increasing polyphenol concentration of people's diets, even if that means with supplementation, such as the one that you've described in the intervention for the POMI tea, as well as the one that you're doing right now with COVID, do you think there's a rationale for the government to be subsidizing polyphenol-rich supplements to people's diets, as we can't always be relied on, and myself included, to eat well every single day?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the number one message is to eat well.
Yeah, of course, that goes without saying.
And like yourself, I try to make an effort. But if I'm exercising a lot, or you know, I've had a stressful day, I will definitely take some extra supplements. Mm. Or in the probiotic side, if I'm going on holiday, with different water, different types of foods, I will definitely cover myself with a probiotic. Mm. If you've been in hospital or taken a course of antibiotics, there's lots of indications. Yeah. You should never take a probiotic daily if you're otherwise well. Mm. There's no evidence for that. But there's many situations where they would help. Mm. So yes, I you know, it was beginning to get to a situation that Norfolk and Norwich, for example, were giving probiotics for people before they were admitted to hospital.
Oh, really?
There's evidence to reduce the risk of Clostridium infection.
Gotcha.
There's a new strategy run by the Royal College of Anaesthetists called the Prehabilitation Programme, where they're looking at people coming into hospital, and they're mainly talking about exercise to try to sort of reduce the risk of thrombotic events. Mm-hmm. But I think I was on that committee, and I was trying to sort of introduce, maybe that's an opportunity to sort of try to really change people's diet, even if it's only for 3 or 4 weeks, to really arm them with polyphenols and the right bacteria to reduce the risk of adverse events, reduce the risk of infection. And actually, going forward, you know, I think if you can change the environment in the body around, say, a cancer, you start getting changes in that cancer. So if you do get these cells spreading off at the time of surgery, it's maybe less likely to form roots and metastasize. But that's all in the sort of research domain at the moment.
Yeah, because from my limited understanding of cancer research, a lot of it is reactive at this point. We spend the large majority of our money on medications, toxic drugs, surgery, which all have their place massively. But if you ask me, I'd rather try and prevent myself from getting cancer in the first place. And my understanding of how much we spend in preventative medicine is less than 5% of the total NHS budget, which is very, very small. And there's a lot of evidence that we can prevent a lot of these things if we start early enough, and also detect as well. So, yeah, I think that definitely needs to...
It does. The problem is preventative interventions haven't been particularly successful. So, yeah, I mean, we know from World Cancer Research Fund, WHO, Cancer Research UK, who have done very clever statistics, that about 50% of cancers could be avoided if we led a healthy lifestyle. The others, you know, I'm not blaming people for getting cancer. Some people live the life of an angel and still get it. But also there's some evidence that if you have a healthier lifestyle and you get the cancer, it's going to be later in life and perhaps less aggressive and more amenable to being cured. But, you know, you tell a, you know, you tell your teenage kids to eat healthily because they might get cancer in 20 years' time. It's sort of falling on deaf ears, really. You know, so that's why they're not investing more, I think, because it's not changing behavior, and it's getting people to change their behavior is the hard bit.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's definitely a motivational element of, you know, investing now and with a payoff later, but it's also about I think looking at the wider determinants of health. It's something that I've come to realize throughout my 6 years of working as a general practitioner. It's easy for me to arm people with the information. It's harder to appreciate the other determinants: time, financial insecurity, stress, and all the other things that will predict as to whether they're going to be able to cook one of my meals every day, or, you know, whether they're going to fall into old habits or going to be, you know, susceptible to the advertising from the junk food industry.
So. In your books, which I've read, are fantastic, and certainly in mine as well. What we're talking about preventing chronic disease through diet. Mm. So we know, we talked about cancer, about 50% of them could be prevented. Mm. But actually things like arthritis, heart disease, premature aging, Parkinson's disease, stroke, these are all, you know, related to chronic inflammation and gut health. And they can definitely be, the incidence can be reduced. Mm. We're not going to get rid of them. But when you get them is going to be, you know, in a much older age and a less severe form. Mm. But what COVID is perhaps changing the goalposts here is, if you say to someone who's you know, overweight, has a poor diet, you say, come on, you need to try to change because you will avoid the risk of chronic disease in 20 years' time, they may not be so interested. Mm. But actually with COVID, what it's showing is people who have these comorbidities are more likely to get a fatal illness now. Mm. So actually, COVID, you know, the horrible, terrible catastrophe that might actually be getting people thinking, well, actually, maybe I need to be changing now, not to prevent a disease in 20 years' time, to prevent a disease which could happen next week.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, you can't, you know, become from obese to normal overnight. But actually, a lot of the evidence, so it's the process of changing is more important. Mm. So you can be, you know, overweight, but still quite healthy. Mm. So if you change your diet and you exercise more, that can start changing your gut health. It can reduce your estrogen levels before you start seeing a reduction in weight. Mm. And this is what I try to say to the patients, you know, don't be despondent that you go on the scales and you only see a little bit. Mm. The processes you're doing is improving your health before you see reductions in actual weight.
Yeah, yeah. I, as harsh as it sounds, I think COVID has really brought to attention the importance of healthy eating and that motivational element of it having an impact tomorrow. Mm. Is something that is kicking a lot of people into gear. And I think everyone's motivations are different. You know, some people are motivated by money or time or aesthetics. Mm. I think most of us are motivated also by fear as well. And again, as harsh as it sounds, the fact that tens of thousands of people have died in this country alone, and we're witnessing this on a global level, it has sparked a lot of fear. And I think a lot more people are motivated to do something about poor health habits that we all have, you know, we're all privy to it.
I hope so. I'd like to see, you know, the evidence for that coming through, that people are changing their lifestyle. I mean, without criticizing the government, I mean, it's been a very hard process for every government in the world. I find it a little bit odd looking at the data, which is very obvious, you know, it's all published. The New York data is fantastic. Mm. The Chinese data is coming out. This issue with, you know, over 50 have to lock down. I mean, it's, you just go on to the Chinese publication. Age is irrelevant.
Yeah.
Age is just a correlation that you've got something else wrong with
you. Yes, yeah.
The data shows very clearly you can be in your late 80s, but if you've got no comorbidities, you have no more risk of COVID. It's not an age thing. It's a disease thing. And you can be in your 30s and 40s and have lots of problems, which is going to increase your risk. But it's only till recently they've started saying, oh, let's get on your bike. Let's do more exercise. You know, this is a great opportunity. We know that smoking increases your risk of the lung damage. You know, there should have been campaigns saying, you know, stop smoking. There are some countries, Italy, for example, have banned smoking, haven't they?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm sure that's... I'd love to verify that story because I was only told by Italian. But you know, some countries are saying, look, you know, we know that excess alcohol, we know that smoking's bad. Mm. Use this as an opportunity as well as a risk. But, you know, I think it should be a step further. Mm. You know, I think there should be, okay, we don't have grade A evidence yet. You know, the trial I'm doing is trying to get that, and there's some others around the world. But, you know, it's not going to do any harm saying to people, come on, instead of 5 a day vegetables, you should be doing 10 of 8 vegetables. You should be, you know, just trying to exercise every day, keeping your weight down if possible. Mm. Vitamin D, again, we need more evidence. And I was very surprised that there was an official thing saying, announcement saying there's no evidence that vitamin D influences COVID. But, you know, at the end of the day, many people in Britain are vitamin D deficient.
Yeah, exactly.
And we know there's hundreds of other benefits of vitamin D. And even if it could possibly be relevant, it's a cheap thing you can take over the counter, or just go and take your shirt off and lie in the park for half an hour. You know, so I think we should be concentrating more on that without blaming people, of course.
Yeah.
The last thing we want to do, but just encouraging people to change. Yeah.
on that note, I'm going to serve up this meal, which is definitely polyphenol rich, and I hope that you're going to enjoy it.
The thing I try to tell people is not to snack between meals. So I've had my breakfast at 8 o'clock. So I haven't had anything since.
Do you intermittently fast at all, or do you have an eating window?
I don't. And I'm not saying the data's not okay for that. If you looked at the 5-2 diet of Michael Mosley, who's actually shares the same publisher, so I should encourage that. It's all very good. if you actually looked at the data, I mean, the best data is the overnight fasting. If you can go 13 hours overnight. Extrapolating from that, I think, you know, having your breakfast at 7:38 and then eating nothing till 1 o'clock, I think that that leaving your stomach to empty actually makes letting your insulin pathways die down. Having food in your stomach all the time is really unhealthy. It's not good for the amount of carcinogens in the food. It's not good for your gut enzymes. It affects your PhD, and your system's in overdrive all the time. Just giving it a rest and is my take on it.
It's one of the recommendations I give to patients to really think about, just that simple act of giving yourself a bit of a rest overnight. And like you said, if you're constantly eating, your gut's never having a rest, and it does need a little bit of a break. Let's get you eating. I want you to try.
Well, I had breakfast at 8. It's now 2 o'clock, okay. So I've had to...
You're probably ravenous. Okay, so this is the Greek-style beans. You can imagine taking this to the table and then doing the feta and the parsley at the table, but I'm going to serve it for you in a bowl, so it's easier. I'm sure you don't want to just dive into this.
I can smell it. It
smells smell-wise?
Really, yeah, yeah, it's really nice.
Good. Okay, and obviously just dodge the parsley and the big stick of cinnamon. But I mean, one of the reasons why I cook like this is not only because of the health benefits and the impact that can have, but it's for the enjoyment of food as well. I mean, that's why the recipes sort of skip through different cultures and cuisines. It's a way in which we celebrate different cultures and stuff, and share food.
I hear from patients sometimes and friends, I don't want to live till 100. I prefer to enjoy myself. But you say we're actually talking about things which are more enjoyable than white bread with plastic cheese on. It's a strange quirk of nature that foods which are healthy generally taste really good as well.
Exactly.
An all-win situation.
And I think it's like about retraining our taste buds as well. If you are sort of that, if you do like the white bread and plastic cheese, which I refuse to believe over a long term, you can like learn to enjoy flavors very, very gently. You don't have to go straight into it. Okay. Tiny bit of seasoning. And there we go. Oh, let me give you a spoon.
Look at this.
It might be a little bit hot, so maybe... Yeah.
Well, I'm used to eating beans. So
But
as you say, some people might be put off by the beans if they're not used to it. But you have to break that barrier.
Yes.
To say,
yeah, definitely.
So this is straight out of the oven. Am I going to burn myself live on...
You'll be fine. You just give it a blow, and then you'll be okay.
Well, it looks fantastic.
Good.
It smells really nice.
I hope your kids enjoy it as well.
You've kept the celery a little bit crisp, which is good.
Yeah.
If I'd done this, that would be a soggy slush in the background.
The leeks are soft, but the celery gives a bit of crunch.
Yeah, so it's got a crunch and the beans.
But the flavours have tried to keep quite traditional in the way you might find it in like a Greek restaurant.
But this, I love the way the beans... the oregano sort of got absorbed into the beans and it tastes a bit oregano.
I'm taking it you like
impressed
it. Yeah.
But as I said, I'm gonna have to make it and I'll courier it down to you or something.
Please do. Yeah.
This is going down a treat.
Good. Well, I hope your kids like it as well.
Do you want to see if they like it?
yeah go on.
Amma.
What do you think?
It's really good.
It's good? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Great.
Do you think Dad could make that for you?
No.
I'm going to prove to you he can, honestly. He's definitely going to be able to make that.
I've been taught. I'm going to do it next week.
She doesn't look particularly convinced.
I think you're wrong. I think I'm going to be a cordon bleu master chef.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for the tap on the show.
Yeah, yeah. 'Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Remember, you can get all the show notes on thedoctorskitchen.com/podcast and check out the details of the study that's going on, the ingredients that have been put into the food and a pill supplementation, as well as Professor's brilliant book, as well as his future book as well, that'll be coming out later this year. I think you're going to absolutely love it, and I can't wait to talk about it more. Take care, and I will see you here next week.